And good morning and welcome to Focus. This is hour number two of our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour of the show, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking a bit about what's going on these days in libraries, and try to talk really about a couple of different kinds of libraries. For most people, the library that they know is their community library, and that is a certain kind of institution, and it serves a certain kind of need. Also, at a place like the University of Illinois, we have libraries. We have a number of them, very big ones. It is true that with places like this, modern research libraries, they face a very broad mandate because they have to serve a very diverse collection of people, faculty, students. They have to reflect all the disciplines that are taught in the university, everything where people are doing research. And a place like the Library of the University of Illinois has some very old books and some very new ones in different formats, in different languages. So we'll try to talk a little bit about how university libraries work to meet those challenges, particularly the demand for things that are published in languages other than English. And we are happy to have here on the program as our guest, Deborah Jacobs. She's the Vice Provost for Library Affairs at Duke University. She's really the person who is the head administrators for all of the libraries there at Duke. And she's visiting the campus to give a talk. And her talk here is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs. It's based here on this campus, and it indeed is an outfit that's all about bringing together library people from all over the world and to provide training in the most modern and cutting-edge ways of doing library and information science. She'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the campus at 4, and this is, I'm sure, something that would be open to anybody who is interested in attending. She'll be giving her talk in room 66 of the library. Welcome. Anybody should feel welcome to attend. Here on this program, anybody should feel welcome to call. If you have questions, comments, you can give us a call. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-doc@illinois.edu. Our guest, Deborah Jacobs, has been at Duke for a while. She served as Director of Collection Services for the Duke University Libraries. She was the founding head of the International and Area Studies Department. She was the librarian for Latin America and Iberia in Duke's Perkins Library, and in fact came to library studies after having gotten a PhD in Latin American history at Stanford. So that's a particular interest of hers. And as we talk, as I say, questions are certainly welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This you suggested maybe it would be interesting to talk about how it is you got into the library field after having been somebody who had studied and worked in the area of Latin American history. So how did you do that?
Well, it's a question I often get. How did you come to library work from an academic track, a different kind of academic track? And I like to say it was because of the 1976 coup in Argentina, which meant that I had to postpone my dissertation research and come up with an entirely new dissertation topic. And so during that time, that year, I was out of the cycle for requesting outside funding for dissertation work. I was doing some work in the libraries for the Latin American curator, and it wasn't kind of an overnight conversion where I thought, oh, this is so much more interesting than my single topic dissertation or anything like that. But it kind of planted the seed for me of the role of the library and how the role of an area studies librarian is such a perfect window into the cultures of different countries. And I came up with my new topic. I went off to do my research and lived in Argentina. I came back and resumed working part-time for this same curator, Jim Breedlove, while I was writing my dissertation. And then it was kind of an evolution. One of the main administrators in the Stanford Library said, the field needs people like you. You should consider getting a library degree. And so I was actually writing my dissertation and also enrolled in the library science program at the University of California at Berkeley simultaneously. So I was a a Cal-Stanford student, I suppose, at the same time, and then married another historian who is now an administrator in the university at Duke. And we didn't think we'd find jobs in the same place. It was, you know, as two historians trying to live in one place and be married. And so I pursued a library career, and I started at Duke. Never meant to stay as long as I have, but it's been a great place.
Yeah. Well, this maybe leads to a question about how big research libraries are structured. There are, to put this very, very generally, there's, I'm sure that there's one big library that has, it has everything in it. Or almost everything. You know, maybe then, maybe your engineering library is a separate place, and maybe your medical library is a separate place, but that there will be sort of one big library that has a kind of a general mandate. Mm-hmm. But then you also will have libraries for example, for Latin American studies, or for Asian studies, or for African American studies, or for and that will have maybe a little bit more specialized collections. And I'm sure that here it becomes more, the responsibilities of the person who oversees that collection become more complicated, because not only are you do you need to know about the things that librarians need to know about, mm-hmm. but if you're making selections for that collection, you have to know about that subject area, and you may indeed have to be able to read Spanish or Korean or, mm-hmm. or what have you. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's my impression that maybe there's some controversy within the library field about, well, truly, could a generalist be an area librarian, or do you need to have somebody who has special background that the generalist doesn't have?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that someone who is the librarian for a region should be able at least to read the language. Mm. Your responsibility is not just for selecting materials, but working with students and faculty to help them with their research. And it's very important for faculty to trust the person who is their area specialist to understand the research questions they're pursuing and the nature of scholarship, and also the nature of the publishing industry in the country or the regions. I mean, Latin America, we talk about Latin America as if it were a single place, but there are 20 countries. So the same is true of Eastern Europe. A Slavic specialist has a big responsibility, a lot of different areas. I think one of the dynamics currently going on, and we don't have separate libraries for area studies or anything, but we had branch libraries for the sciences, but we've now merged those because of all the interdisciplinary work that's going on. So there's a lot more interest in cross-regional, overarching questions that would affect all different area studies, formerly separate regions. Human rights, for example, water resources, questions of format, you know, what are we doing about preserving websites that detail, say, elections in different countries? So there are all kinds of new questions that an area specialist has to be dealing with and able to handle in the languages of the region.
Mm. I guess I hadn't really appreciated how much that in a library like yours or like ours, that the librarians would be research partners with faculty, mm-hmm. and be really very actively involved in helping that person. So it could be a faculty person, it could be somebody working on a PhD, you know, mm-hmm. whoever it is, helping them find what it is that they need.
Well, that's absolutely true. I guess if I were to give you a simple kind of timeline of the development of this specialization, a lot of area studies librarians really began as catalogers, because you needed to know the language to catalog the materials that the libraries were acquiring. Some of those people went on to get responsibility for doing collection development, selecting materials, making sure that the materials you're acquiring for the library are are the kinds of things that the faculty need for their research and that they need for their teaching as well. And then over the years, major research libraries have developed a cadre of area specialists who are doing more partnering, as you've put it, collection development, engagement with their faculty and students, working with them in much different ways. So they've kind of come out of the back room in a way where they used to be more of a behind-the-scenes person. Many of our specialists are now working in academic departments. They're performing some administrative roles in some of the area study centers. They're really seen as partners in the whole academic enterprise. Mm.
Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Deborah Jacobs. You have to help me with this. You're the Rita D.
Giallinardo.
Giallinardo Holloway University Librarian.
Yes, named for Rita D. Giallinardo Holloway, who is on our board, and the position was named by her husband, Ben Holloway, who's a Benjamin Duke Holloway, member of the Duke family.
All right. And she's also vice provost for library affairs at Duke. She is essentially the head administrator of all the Duke University.
With the exception of a couple of the professional school libraries, the medical library. Okay.
And she's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking with her this morning, continue to talk with her this morning. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. She's visiting here. Her visit is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs, and she'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock, particularly looking at this, this issue of global scholarship and research libraries. I'm sure that libraries like yours face some of the same issues that community libraries face, in that there is more and more demand for more and more stuff. And so the library has to be thinking about all the various materials that they need to have. So, for example, in a community library, it used to be, well, you needed to have books and magazines, I suppose. You have books and periodicals. But, of course, now you have to have music and you have to have movies and you have to have all kinds of things. And you probably also provide people with some internet access and, you know, a wide range of things. I'm sure for the university library, a similar sorts of thing applies, as there's so much published in the world and you have to be able to somehow make that available to your patrons. So an increased demand, I'm sure. And when you talk about area studies, though, I'm thinking about how it is you balance the need for, say you only have so much money, and there's something that you want to get, you figure 200 people, 500 people are going to read. And then there might be something that you would want to have for your area library that 5 people would read. Is there tension then, you know, when people are sitting down and thinking about budgets, they're going to say, well, you know, this is good and everything, but only 5 people are going to use this. Here's this other thing that 1,000 people are going to use. How do you work that out?
Well, there are dedicated funds for each of the areas. I think it's unfortunate that we have to quantify things in the way you've described, although mm-hmm. that is something that we see happening a lot, the whole return on investment movement. Mm-hmm. Where area studies, libraries and their collections and their librarians have been very successful is in cooperation across institutions. So the University of Illinois, for example, in a number of their area studies libraries, is part of a network of libraries. So Duke might have strengths in certain areas. Illinois would have strengths in complementary areas, or Duke and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which is our partner in the Triangle Research Libraries Network, have consciously developed complementary collections. Mm-hmm. And area studies librarians as a group are excellent at this kind of collaboration because they've learned to deal with scarcity. They know that their clientele are relatively small. And those faculty in area studies have been very appreciative of all of the efforts that are going on nationally. A lot of the work with the Title VI National Resource Centers through the Department of Education is based on cooperation, collaboration, complementarity. So faculty in area studies are probably less demanding in some areas to have materials on site. They understand that they may have to wait a day or a couple days to get something because it's part of a much larger network of collaboratively built collections. And that's been the success of area studies.
And to what extent now is a lot of the material digitized so that the physical object doesn't have to leave wherever it lives, that someone anywhere can have access?
Well, that's an excellent question and one of the things that I'm very interested in getting more data on. But I think a lot of the time when people talk about international collections, what they mean is Great Britain, Western Europe. They're not really thinking about a lack of a digital infrastructure for, say, e-books coming out of Africa or coming out of some parts of Latin America. There's great unevenness around the world in production of digital materials. There's simply not the infrastructure, there's not the funding, and yet scholars in those areas need access, and scholars in the United States need access to the materials coming out of these regions. So that unevenness is something I'd like to try to remind people of, that we can't just make blanket statements about, well, everything's going to be digital. There's still a lot of what we call gray literature in the profession, ephemeral materials, things to do with, say, elections or issues of, some kinds of earthquakes, natural disasters, the kinds of things that you wouldn't – they're not books. They're things that don't live very long. They're pamphlets or they're broadsides. And a lot of these things really need to be sought out actively by librarians who then collect them and make them available possibly through digital means. So creating digital collections of our own holdings can be a way of expanding access to them. But it, you know, that takes money as well.
Yeah. Do you are there places where, again, and I guess this might involve overestimating the potential for using electronic means to distribute material, but are places where they say, well, do we really need to have a Latin American studies library or an Asian library or a Slavic library if, after all, we can go online and the University of Illinois has it or Duke has it or UNC has it or UC Berkeley has it or someplace, you know, one of the places where there are the big institutions, they have big libraries, they have lots of material. There must be places where they're saying, well, we don't need to spend the money to do that. All you got to do is go online and you can access the collections of these major institutions.
Well, a couple things about that. I mean, libraries and universities of all different sizes have different emphases and different, and I would say that, you know, large research libraries may or may not have a strong Latin American or Slavic or African program. Smaller colleges, of course, will not collect those materials, and they'll use interlibrary loan. The issue of going online for things, though, assumes that these books are digitized in their entirety, which they're not, because of copyright issues, because of funding issues. Some materials that are outside the public domain might have been digitized, possibly through the Google Books project or something like that. But it's not as simple as getting, you know, and having an online library of everything ever published, because there are many, many barriers that are legal and technological to that.
Mm. So there will there ever be an online library of everything ever published?
Ever is a long time. I don't know. In my lifetime, certainly not. But, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that even though a lot more is digitized or available in digital form, and especially the journal literature and the sciences, that sort of thing, libraries such as Duke's and Illinois are still buying a lot of print books, and more print materials are being published worldwide every year. So we live in a dual kind of world. It's not an either-or. Mm-hmm. We're still acquiring print. We're signing licenses to get access to digital information, but it's not going to be, a sort of turn the switch on and off and now everything's digital. I mean, I'll get a question from time to time from a donor or someone who's walking through the library with me on a tour, and they'll say, what percentage of your collection is digitized now? And, you know, it's an innocent, perfectly good question, but, you know, the answer to that is something over 50% of what we acquire is acquired in digital form. So we're getting more and more materials in digital form, but we're still acquiring things in print because for some things that's the only way to get them, and particularly with international materials.
Well, is there a growing demand for print things that are printed and that are written in languages other than English?
Is there a demand?
I'm sure there is a demand. I think what I meant to ask is, have you seen an increase in demand for that kind of material?
I think it's a steady demand. Yeah. I mean, the biggest change is that we're moving very much away from print journals. I mean, journal articles are pretty easy to read online on your screen. A book, that's a different thing. And no matter how much publishers or others might want to move to that model. I mean, Kindles are a nice invention. They're, you know, I see them more and more as I travel. People have them with them. But the 300,000 e-books that we license at Duke cannot be loaded onto a Kindle. I mean, there are issues of rights. There, it's not as simple as that. There's no single platform for e-books. Whereas a print book, you take it out, you can take it with you, you can loan it to someone, you can give it to someone, you can do lots of things with it that you can't do with ebooks. So it's still it's not an either or thing. There are different formats for different kinds of information. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing with students, we have e-reserves like most libraries do, so they can go and read their reserve reading for any particular class online. But what they do is they print it out and they carry it with them and they highlight it. They still like to have that print with them. So it's an interesting time to be in libraries, mm-hmm. for sure.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Deborah Jacobs. She is the Rita D. Gelinato Holloway University Librarian and Vice Provost for Library Affairs at Duke University. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email if you would like it, to put in your question that way. It's will-talk. I think if you just send it to Will Talk, it will get here. And if you have question or comment, you can certainly be part of the conversation. Over time, I have had probably a fair number of conversations with people in the library field. People like you, going back to the time when we were just moving into the era of ebooks and material being digitized and accessible that way. I mean, when the first time we might have talked about it in this program, but there weren't any Kindles. Then, you know, there at that point, we really didn't even have the hardware. People were talking about, well, would people read books on their desktop computer?
Right.
Well, now I think that the hardware has caught up, so it's much more acceptable. And we know that there are a lot of people who do, you know, read books that way. And for community libraries, they're starting to loan books in that fashion. And I guess one of the questions right from the beginning was for any kind of library, what did the coming of the ebook and the ability to access this material electronically mean for the brick and mortar library? And all kinds of librarians were asking that question. Community librarians were asking, well, what does this mean for us? And the issues are probably different, but I'm sure that at big research libraries, people like you, we're asking that same question. What does that mean for us? And I'm sure that there were some people who said this is going to be the greatest thing ever, and that there are some people who said this is the end of the world. Now, today, how does this look?
Well, I think most libraries are concerned about space, physical space, and whether they can continue to grow and grow and grow and add books to their stacks. Libraries like ours and the libraries of Illinois have off-site facilities. I never call it a storage facility for a variety of reasons, because materials come and go from ours every day. About 2,000 items are retrieved and loaned. So it's not the connotation of storage really is kind of negative. It makes you think that you have these millions of books sitting unused in a warehouse, when in fact, when we first built our offsite facility, we went through librarians, trained librarians, went through the stacks and identified materials that hadn't circulated in at least 12 years. It had to do with whether they were barcoded or not. We thought, aha, here we have a great body of work that, you know, probably won't be retrieved. And yet it comes back a lot. It's retrieved all the time. And our faculty have become quite happy having the offsite facility, first of all, because the materials are brought to them. They don't even need to go find them. And secondly, because they're preserved in much better conditions than in our stacks. So there was a certain, well, what about serendipity? I can't browse the stacks anymore. Things are offsite. And that's been replaced by, oh, these things are always on the shelf in the offsite. We have a high density, you know, I don't know how many stories high it is, but it's 50 degrees in there. So these materials are going to stay around for a lot longer. But my point really is that you can't predict what will and will not circulate. And I think anyone who has done any kind of research in a large library has been surprised and thrilled to find certain things on the shelves that they never expected to find. And the first thing you think, or the first thing I think, is, I wonder who bought this and why. What did they know I would come along and find this? I mean, this issue of serendipity, some of the most obscure materials, as you say, they may appeal to only five people, but they could be the key element in someone's research. So that's one of the big issues we're dealing with. Now, I've gotten off the question of ebooks that you asked me about, but you know, I think what we're doing is we're expanding our holdings very rapidly by licensing a bunch of ebooks in a way that we couldn't do with print books. We can't buy 300,000 more print books like just like that by licensing them. So we're expanding access for our users to a much wider body. We're also trying out some experiments like loading records into the catalog for ebooks that we don't yet own, quote unquote, and seeing how the users respond to that. So you wouldn't even know if you were searching our catalog. You would just be looking for some information on a topic, and you would come across a book, and if 5 or 10 people access that book, and it's not just click once, it's get down to a certain level, that book will automatically be bought for the libraries. This is something called patron-driven acquisitions. And it has a lot of surprises for librarians, because we've carefully kind of assembled the collections we have over the years. And lo and behold, users are telling us, well, I want this or I want that. And it might be a book that you never thought really belonged in your collection or you needed in your collection. And yet, we were quite surprised with the books. And I think libraries around the country are experimenting with the same thing.
We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Deborah Jacobs. She's the Vice Provost for Library Affairs at Duke University. She's visiting the campus here. We'll talk some more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Federal Reserve made one of its most critical oversight decisions in the wake of the financial crisis, a decision favorable to the banks, and why the FDIC objected. We'll talk with Jesse Eisinger about his investigative article published jointly by ProPublica and The Atlantic. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning on the show, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll have another visit with this guy we like to call our chef in residence, Doyle Moore. He's been stopping by here once a month for a very long time. We always have fun with him talking about cooking, and I'm not even sure what we're going to talk about tomorrow. We'll find out, and we'll let you know. Also tomorrow, in the second hour, the 11 o'clock hour, the guest is Sandra Beasley. She's an award-winning poet and writer who has, for a lot of her life, been living with severe allergies, and she's written a memoir on this that we'll be talking about. The title of her book is Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life. And then Thursday at 10 o'clock, the guest is Eric Kleinenberg. He's a sociologist from New York University, and we will talk about his recent book, Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. And that's just part of what we'll be doing this week. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. Also want to mention that today at noon, we'll have live coverage from National Public Radio of a presidential press conference. It's possible that the president might have something to say about the fact that this is Super Tuesday and we've got a presidential election going. He just did meet with the prime minister of Israel and so might likely say something about the threat posed by Iran or how the United States wants to respond to what's going on in Syria. So a number of things that he was likely to be talking about, and we'll have live coverage, and you can hear it on WILO beginning at noon today. You can follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. We're also on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, I am talking with Deborah Jacobs. She is the Rita DiGelinardo Holloway University Librarian and also Vice Provost for Library Affairs at Duke University, which is administrator for almost all the libraries at Duke. She's visiting here, the campus. The folks at the Mortenson Center have brought her here to talk about the global dimensions of scholarship and research libraries. This is this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus in room 66 of the library. I'm sure anybody who would like to hear what she has to say should feel welcome to stop by. Questions, too, are welcome here as we talk about libraries, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you like, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. I guess what I do think is interesting, again, going back to this question is about, you know, what's the future of the brick-and-mortar library? Mm-hmm. So as what you have said, and I'm sure that it's true all over, as demand goes up, you still, even though you're doing some things electronically, you're still buying material in print. There's still demand for that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that it's the same thing for a community library, for a university library. It's not just a place people go to get books. It's a place people go because it's a place to be, to get together. Students come to study. They come to get together. People at the community level come for all sorts of things. I think there are a lot of places where people would say their community library is a very important community institution. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who would say yes, and at the university in some important ways, things revolve around that university. That's an important place, and that's also a kind of a need that the library has to respond to.
That's an excellent point, David. The students, particularly since the renovation of our library, which made it go from a almost scary kind of dim library with orange shag carpeting in the, well, not quite shag, but it was not a pretty sight. Mm-hmm. In the reference area, it's now been, over the past decade, it's been completely modernized. We doubled our space. We added a new library that's part of the main library, the Bostock Library. And students have flocked to it. We have gone from, in the past 3 years, something like 660,000 visits to 2 million people coming in and out. So someone comes into the library like every 10 seconds. Now, you might ask, well, so much is online. Why do students need to come to the library? And I've asked students that. I've said, you know, why do you come here? You could study in your dorm. You could get access to a lot of things that way. And the answers I get are things like, the library is where I go when I want to get serious. It's also, at the same time, a social hub, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of alumni I've met over the years who've said they've met their spouses in the library. I'm thinking of doing a sort of a Valentine's Day issue of our magazine about spousal meetings in the libraries. But, you know, it's a place where students will work hard. They'll get up. They'll go get something to eat or drink. They'll come back. They'll talk with someone. They'll see someone in a class of theirs. They'll sit down, work again. We're open all night, 5 nights a week, and until midnight on Friday and Saturday. So it's a place that is buzzing around the clock. And as we know, students' hours are different from ours in terms of when they can get their best work done. Mm-hmm. So it really is a hub of activity. Just going into another topic, kind of building on something you asked before, I've been meeting with people this morning and talking about new roles of the libraries. And one of them that I want to mention here is the role of the library in being a repository of data that faculty produce or use in their work. And that's something that I think libraries are all dealing with. We've been the place that preserve materials, books, journals, archives, documents, early drafts of the work of writers, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And data is increasingly the raw material of some of the newest scholarship. The library is also the place where, the role the library plays is very important in some of the requirements of some of the funding agencies nationally, NIH, NSF, for researchers to have a data management plan. So before they can get these grants, they need to have planned to preserve and make accessible their data. So the library is now in this business, which is bringing us into partnership with our IT people on campus. But there are always new roles for libraries around every corner.
Yeah. In thinking about the conversation we're going to have, I came across a little clip of another university head librarian. This was it was someone in Florida, wherever it is the Gators are.
That's the University of Florida. Yeah.
And she was
Judy Russell.
She was giving a little talk, and she said to the people that she was talking to, well, what institution on this campus do you think had more visitors? Was it the football stadium? Was it the place where they play basketball? Or was it their main library? Mm-hmm. And I guess whoever was listening to this talk was clued in enough to know, well, of course, it was the library. More people go to the library than people turn out to see the football team play. And it was just an astounding number. And I'm sure that in your library, it would be the same thing. And I'm sure that at the University of Illinois libraries, it would be the same thing. An astounding number of patrons. People come through the door every month, year, when the school is in session. And it must be one of the most highly trafficked places on the entire campus.
It is. And speaking of athletics, we've worked out a great deal with our athletics department this year. Kevin White, who's the athletics director, and I decided that we should have some kind of partnership. So the Duke University Libraries are already getting $1 from every ticket sold to every home athletics event for all sports that collect for tickets. So that's a great partnership from my perspective, and it also shows the importance of the library to the athletics program.
Yeah. Just going back a little bit to you were talking about how what's required, what's expected of the library has just grown and grown and grown. And you mentioned the fact that now not only are you the repository of a wide range of material that's on some kind of paper and also in electronic form, but also you're serving as a kind of a storage facility for the enormous amounts of data that are collected by scholars in their research. So that says, well, obviously people who are working in the library have to know about databases and have to know about that sort of thing, which I'm sure has now become an important part of the training for people who are in library sciences before now. But I guess I also am interested in have you talk about how people who go into the library field are trained. And I guess it's my sort of understanding is that it's not the idea that someone should have a lot of cross-discipline training is not automatic. You know, that is that that you might have somebody who would, say, do a dual degree in library and information science and Spanish or Latin American history or Asian history or whatever. I mean, is that true, that there's not as much of that as maybe that there needs to be?
Well, there are a number of MLS programs that have joint degrees. I think yeah. Indiana University is a place where they've done some of that. I guess it's become clear to me that there are many paths into library work. Mm-hmm. It used to be that you kind of had to have a library degree to do this work, but increasingly I'm seeing people move from in the, say, instructional technology field, or people who may have a PhD or a master's degree and a lot of experience working in libraries but not a library science degree. It's disciplines like history are looking at what they used to call alternative career paths, and kind of refocusing that on different kinds of career paths. It used to be that it was assumed that if you got a PhD in history, you would teach history. That was, you know, you'd be a college professor. Mm-hmm. And now there are a lot more opportunities for people with those skills, writing skills, research skills, and technology skills, to move into, say, digital humanities work, which is rising in our universities. And libraries are responding to that. The department that's probably growing the most quickly in our library is the data and GIS, the geographic information systems area. We've just hired a visualization specialist. We've got a humanities technology consultant. So we're seeing much more complex technology issues that are incorporated into research projects, including with seniors who are doing their senior honors theses on a topic that might require data GIS. So say someone is studying the incidence of lead paint in a particular city and health issues, or location of grocery stores in different communities and the kinds of nutrition issues they have. So a lot of these questions require very complicated data analysis and GIS, and the library has risen to meet some of those needs. So I can't quite remember exactly how I got to this point, but I think it's the diversity of roles that we're playing.
Yeah. Well, so there is indeed increasing demand for people who are, I think I was reading something that you wrote and talked about, that there are a lot of libraries who are really eager to hire people that they're, I think the phrase that you used were electronic access librarians.
Well, that was a long time ago.
That was a long
probably.
Time ago. Yeah. Okay.
They don't call that anymore, but yes.
So people whose thing is they come out of IT, or they're very experienced in IT, or it's that idea again that that's the person that if I can sit down on a computer and if such a thing can be had that way, they're the person that are going to be able to get it.
Well, right? I think library schools have all gotten quite modern about these things. I mean, the library school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, SILS, the School of Information and Library Science, has an information science track and a library science track. We've hired a number of people from there who come out of the information science track to work in our digital library programs and things like that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we hire people with a library science track. There's a certain amount of technology, of course, involved in that. So I think what I see is, you know, it's kind of cool to work in a library these days. They're much more, you know, it used to have a sort of a, you know, kind of a negative stereotype or kind of old-fashioned, but it's attracting a lot of younger people to work in the libraries because of the technology issues and because of the opportunities to just go in new directions. And so I'm all for looking closely at any candidate who might be a good match for us, whether that person has a library degree or not. I think there are different ways to come into library work. And we, you know, it's a form of diversity, really, to think about people's backgrounds and what they bring to the mix.
So maybe just to connect to this, to what you're going to be talking about with global dimensions of scholarship and research libraries, it certainly is true that this is not exactly new, but it's something that I think we're trying to see more. We're seeing more and more that universities are indeed developing a more global focus, and that is both in a literal sense because more universities have a physical presence that is more global, or maybe they have connections with other universities outside of the United States. So that is the case, and so that the scope of research that people are doing is also going to be more global. What does that mean for the modern research library?
Well, I think it can be a new golden age for area studies in a way. Mm-hmm. I think it highlights the importance of having collections like this. I mean, when you think about big world issues, you know, where would we be if after 9/11 we had no one who knew Middle Eastern languages or who had collected some of the materials that we had? Or, you know, with Afghanistan, you never know where the next world crisis will be. And to be really good global citizens, we need to be well informed about what's happening in the rest of the world. Some of the globalization that's happening or internationalization in universities is being led by professional schools. So this is something different. So the business school might be the first program in another country. And that those are not areas that have traditionally been supported by our area studies librarians. But I think there's a lot of opportunity there. You know, it's we have to keep in mind that it may seem that these are funny languages or things that are not read by many people, but if we want to really educate our students as global citizens and send them abroad and that sort of thing, we need to have the kinds of collections that they'll want to be using in their research when they come back. A lot of students go on study abroad, they come back, and they're hungry to continue that connection with the culture they just left. And we've certainly found that at Duke. And you do that through having materials in the languages, meeting with other people who've been there, that sort of thing. And the library really is important for this.
Yeah. We have a couple of minutes left. I find myself thinking about maybe some of the earliest conversations that I might have had with people about the coming digital age and what that meant for the library. And it may have been brief, but I think maybe there was just a little bit of unease about, you know, does that mean we're going to need that we won't need the library anymore as a brick and mortar institution? And I think fairly quickly people said, no, that's not, we need even more than we did before, and the demand, what people want from their libraries has expanded, and I'm sure that it's as true with the community library, and it's also true with the university research library. So
something I often say, which is that it's both easier and harder to do research now because there's so much information out there, and there's so much information out there. So that's one reason we really do need libraries to continue to help users sort out the valuable information.
So you're thinking you're in a curatorial sense, but also in a research partner sense?
In a research partner sense, working with students, teaching them to be discerning when they come across information. Who's the author of this? I mean, anyone can publish anything on the internet. You could So teaching them to recognize really good information and trustworthy information.
So what really excites you about the future of your field?
Oh, just the diversity of opportunities and the new partnerships with faculty and programs. I think that the library really is a major partner on university campuses. It's the one unit that supports everyone on the campus. It's something Judy Russell would probably say too. Mm-hmm. And I think the opportunities to participate in academic programs in new ways, having people out in departments, librarians working with faculty as partners, is very exciting.
Yeah, is that something that university administrations appreciate?
They do very much. They do very much. Yeah, I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't. It makes perfect sense to me. People who know how to do research, people who understand the information needs, and so it's we'll see. There's no end of possibilities.
All right. There, we'll have to finish up. Our guest, Deborah Jacobs, she is the Vice Provost for Library Affairs at Duke University. She'll be speaking this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4, sponsored by the Mortensen Center for International Library Programs. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.